Okay, we're on. Good morning, everybody. I would like, Amy stole part of my thunder because I wanted to ask how many of you were going on the trip, so I've seen that. I probably won't remember everybody who is, but I would like to know how many of you have been to Greece before, just a show of hands, you don't have to stand up. Okay, a lot of you. So many of you have seen the Parthenon, the real one. How many of you have been inside the Parthenon in Nashville? Okay, that's practically unanimous. Good. Well, I hope that I will be able to tell you things that you did not know or refresh your mind about things that you once knew but things that have slipped out of your head. My brain is like a sieve and things fall out all the time. So I'm not even going to try with names today. Some of you I know, it's wonderful to see longtime friends. I started to say old friends and I decided that was not politic for either of us. Longtime friends and to see new faces, meet new people. We're going to be together 5 weeks, is that right? Yeah. Okay, and that you know that the last week of this program is a tour. We're going to meet at the Parthenon, and I will give you the eyes roll back in your head. Stop already, tour. Although you know we will have covered a lot of that here. I'm going to start with the construction of the ancient Parthenon. This first slide, which is really kind of blurry. It's not a great slide anyway, and having it blown up this big is difficult. But this gives you a bird's eye view of the Acropolis and, here. The Acropolis with the ruins of the Parthenon on it. This is the Agora, which is the ancient city of Athens. Right here is a little temple called the Hephaestion, which is of the same era as the Parthenon and better preserved for reasons we will go into later. The long building here is a reconstruction of the Stoa of Attalus, which is a little, I'm not sure it's as late as the Roman era, but it's post-classical. And this is the home of the American School of Classical Studies, which is the archaeological. I mean, they oversee the archaeological investigations in the Agora. The Acropolis, as you probably know, is an international archaeological site with an international committee overseeing restorations to the various buildings that are left. And one of the interesting things about the buildings on the Acropolis is that as opposed to the typical temple site or sacred site, I guess, which is they're usually built on over long periods of time. The buildings that remain on the Athenian Acropolis are all from a very short window of time. They are all classical and Hellenistic, I guess. I think they all fall into the classical window. Certainly the Parthenon does. The Erechtheion, which is adjacent to the Parthenon. The Temple of Athena Nike, which has been reconstructed on the little promontory that juts out from the face of the Acropolis. And the Propylaea, which is the gateway building. Just trying to think if there's... I've got some other slides to show you, but just to orient you, it's interesting to me to look at this aerial view and see how much distance there is between the Agora and the Acropolis, because when you're there, it doesn't look that distant. And some of this is spit nails, there we go. Some of this is the climb and the ancient Panathenaic way, which was the sacred way that the procession followed every year to honor all the virgins of Athena, formed up in the Agora, wound its way along the Panathenaic way and up the Acropolis and onto the level where the Parthenon and the other buildings are, is still visible. I didn't know that until I went the first time, and I was so excited to actually walk on the Panathenaic Way, and you will be able to do that. It,
Question.
Yes? No. The question was, would I define classical? It is the mid-5th century B.C. Actually, it's longer than it. There's about a 150-year period. The Parthenon's construction, which went from 448 B.C. to 438 or 432, 447 to 438, and that's the dedication. It actually continued. There was some construction as late as 432 B.C., that's right dead center in the classical period. The period that we still study, politics, architecture, philosophy, the great theatrical writings, much of the math that we still study, arose, bubbled up from this incredibly fertile period. It's astounding to me, and it's one of the reasons that I think the study of the Parthenon, both in Athens and in Nashville, is so important, because it is a physical embodiment of this intellectual and artistic flourishing that happened in this time period. Pat, if you will remind me, I will double check the exact dates of the classical period and let you know next week. I talk about it all the time without ever being challenged on exactly those dates. So thanks a lot. And let me say right now, what Pat just did, feel free to do. I want this to be informal. If you have a question, ask it. There's not going to be a formal lecture within a time for questions, although just spit it out. Okay, so we've got the Panathenaic Way that begins here in the Agora and goes along here and around here. Part of it is obscured now, but it went up the steps to the Acropolis. And this is, as I say, a really poor slide, but the Propylaea building, which is the gateway building, is right here. The Parthenon's here. The Erechtheion is here, and it's not very visible right now, but the Temple to Athena Nike is there. There has been a great deal over the last 30 years, a great deal of investigation, restoration, reconstruction of all these extant buildings, and they were, it's fairly unusual, as I said a minute ago, to have so much of a site that was used over millennia, to have the extant buildings all from a fairly narrow time period. And that was partly because what's there now that remains was part of a building program that the ruler of Athens, Pericles, started at the conclusion of the Persian Wars, and that will come up again. For 40 years, the Persian Empire had been seeking to annex what we call Greece today. The Greek city-states, who were discrete political entities, there was no nation of Greece at the time. That actually didn't come until 19th century, but there were all these little city-states, each of whom was a complete and discrete political entity, but they banded together to fight this effort to be overtaken by the Persian Empire. And just to tie it together, it helps me sometimes to put two of my sort of mental timelines together. One of the people in charge during this time period was Xerxes, who was married to Esther. So it, you know, fits in with your biblical timeline as well. It puts the secular and biblical together. Eventually, there was the Battle of Marathon, which is a story that most people know. There was a sea naval battle at Salamis, the Bay of Salamis, and those two things combined finally caused the Persians to sue for a peace treaty. They said, okay, forget it. Y'all are too hard. So there was a peace treaty, and that was in 480. There was some time to settle that down, and then Pericles thought, you know, we've got all these returning soldiers, the people who've been off fighting who now need work. The Persians
got to our under construction temple and destroyed it. We need to rebuild. So let's do this big civic building program. And so that's part of why the buildings are tightly in a tight time period. This slide just gives you, this is actually from the Roman era, so a little later than the time period we're going to mostly talk about, but it gives you a look at the, kind of like that aerial view. So we've got the Acropolis here, so this is oriented a little different from the previous slide, the Agora here, the Areopagus, Hill of Mars, so you will probably be seeing that, and the wall that surrounded the city. Then this, and I don't know, I got this out of a book, so I'm not real sure what the date of this is, but there would have been walls to protect the city and their access to the harbor at Piraeus. Now, of course, nowadays, the modern city of Athens just, it's all over here, and Piraeus is hardly distinct from the city of Athens, but in antiquity, it was. You will see... it's interesting, when I flew into Athens, I thought, wow, it's down in a bowl just like Nashville is, so we've got another connection. It's surrounded by hills, and you see here, I keep doing that, Mount Lycabettus, and there are other little mounds around the city that give it the appearance as you're looking at it, that it's surrounded by hills like Nashville is. They're not as green, I'll tell you that. This is a reconstruction that gives you a little better sense of what approaching the monuments would have looked like. Now, it's all white instead of elaborately polychromed the way it would have been. So we are looking here at the, you've already gotten up most of the way up the hill, and the steps today look very different. They're not real sure what the steps looked like in antiquity, because so much has changed. So much has been built on top of and redone, and they really don't know what the steps looked like. This is a pretty good idea, I think. And you go through the Propylaea, which had an art gallery to one side, which is another connection with the Nashville Parthenon, unintended, I think. But here's the little temple to Athena Nike, the Parthenon, and you can't see the Erechtheion, which is over here. Another thing to point out is that if we had a time machine and were able to go back to the dedication of the Parthenon, we would just be floored at all the color and all the other stuff up there. It was cluttered with some other buildings that were less beautiful, perhaps less important, and they've since been cleared away. And maybe that may be because of other occupations of and uses of the Acropolis, and they were destroyed that way. There were votive offerings. People would come to the Acropolis, which was dedicated to Athena and to Poseidon. Athena in her various guises. And if you wanted some sort of prayer answered, civic prayer, prayer for battle, various other kinds of things, because there were other, occasionally, other gods and goddesses worshipped there, you would bring an offering. And so there were statues, and there were little things, and there were big things, and people who were grateful to Athena for having protected them or given them victory in some situation would bring something, a gift, to say thank you. And so I think we would just be shocked at how messy it looked and how active it was, and probably also how green it was. It's nowadays what we see is exposed rock, but that is mostly a result of 19th century, 18th and 19th century clearing away of the Turkish occupation, actually. And once again, I'll come back to that later, but it was like, get rid of everything, dig it out. And they dug out grass and trees, and there is still the olive tree near the Erechtheion that, do you all know the story of, getting ahead of myself. Okay, we're gonna go. I wanna talk a little about the construction of the building, because part of why people admire it so today is the incredible technical thought and skill that went into creating this building. So I take you now to Mount Pentelikon, or Pendeli, the quarry, not far from Athens, where the marble that was used to make the Parthenon was quarried. So here we have, here is Athens, right there, and Mount Pendeli is in this area here. And you see that the quarries, which are now protected, you can't use the quarries now, but in antiquity, it was unusual on the mainland to have a source of such really high quality marble. And one of the other things that has always made this building seem important and special to people is the fusion of Doric and Ionic elements. And I will go into that later and define those things for you and that sort of stuff. But typically, really great building marble was not found on mainland Greece. They used other stone. They used whatever was available. The temples that were the buildings that were built in the Ionian Islands, in the islands in general, were more likely to be marble. So one associates marble temples with the Ionic order and Doric temples with another kind of stone, limestone or whatever else was available. So having a temple that is made of marble, white marble, is one element that pulls in the sort of Ionic piece of this fusion that the building represents. Now, the tendency also is to think of the Doric order as older than the Ionic order, and that's really not the case. They developed simultaneously, approximately, just in different places, and so when you see an Ionic temple on the mainland, it may be later, because that style came later to the mainland. But these are real broad brush things about time. It's hard to say when some design element arose. There's a big argument about Corinthian columns and how they are later, but how different are they from Ionic columns? The proportions and otherwise shape of the Corinthian column is exactly the same as the Ionic column. Really, it's only the capital that's different. So, and there's an argument that possibly there was a Corinthian element as part of the Parthenon that at least one scholar makes, and we'll look at that later too. Here we've got the workmen in the quarry marking off how they're going to get this piece of marble out. Next several slides are from drawings, pen and ink drawings by Manolis Kores, who was the architect for 25, 30 years, overseeing the work on the Parthenon specifically. Each of the buildings on the Acropolis had a different archaeologist / architect working on the restorations. Manoli was the one for the Parthenon, and so much of what we now know about construction techniques and there have been some new discoveries were because of his work. And one of the things he is most interested in is the nameless, faceless people who did so much wonderful work. The overseers of these crews who quarried the marble had to have organizational skills that are remarkable, and yet nameless and faceless is what we call them, because we know the names of two architects, the ruler of Athens and the sculptor, and those are the ones that have gone down in history and get all the credit. And of course, what they did was overarching over the whole project. Callicrates and Ictinus are the two architects. Phidias, or Phidias, depending on what you like, was the sculptor. And it is probable that Phidias's work was like top dog, because he was in charge of all the sculptural program on the Parthenon, the statue inside, the metopes, the Ionic frieze, both pediments, all the ornamentation. And it is probably because of his work and what he was pushing for that the building has some of the unique features that it does. Obviously, the architects were collaborators in this, or it wouldn't have come to pass. So we're looking at some of these. I want you to see some of how it was apparently done in antiquity. So this is the same spot. This piece of marble, the overseer, the quarryman, has decided would work as a column capital. And he sees, he had to look for flaws in the marble, and some are obvious and some are not. And so a good quarryman developed a really good sense about what might be hidden in the way of acceptable use or flaws that would make it not usable. So these workmen are, as you see, putting in little, you know, I don't have the technical term for that. Somebody who works wood, tell me.
Wedge,
thank you. that is a really technical term. I told you it's a sieve and stuff falls out. Okay, so they're putting in wedges and they're going to lever it up. So they're pounding wedges in all the seams where the quarryman has determined it will crack successfully and along the line he wants. This work... This quarry is Mount Pentelicus, which is about 10 miles from Athens. So that's why they could make this quarry, why they could make this temple out of marble, because this quarry was near enough to be able to do it. They weren't having to import it from an island or from farther on off mainland Greece. So they've got the block detached from the rest of the mountain. They have pulled it up and are putting it on these skids. And you see these things here. And you'll see them again on column drums. They are lifting bosses. They are ways to manipulate these multi-ton blocks of marble so that they, because they can't lift them up, even if they're a bunch of strong men, that's pretty hard. They're using really creative techniques for getting the rock out and to where it needs to be. So they're going to put them on skids here. And also another thing to do is rough dress it, rough cut it, so that it's got the general shape of what they plan to use it for, so that they're not having to move extraneous rock. So this one's going to be a capital, and they have gotten the general shape before they ever try to take it to the site. And they are levering it onto these skids here, and then hauling it out, down and then out, up. So we have skids coming here, and we've got people on these winches pulling up the ropes that are driving it. And they, as they move up the hill, then the skids from behind are put in front, and they just keep going. And then it has to come down the mountainside and get loaded onto a cart. And we are at that point now. And the evidence for this, the reason that Manoli could posit this and draw these beautiful pen and ink drawings is because there are stones from this paving visible. There are holes with some stuff left in them here. So he can, as an engineer and an archaeologist, he was teaching at the Technical University there in Athens before he was tapped to work on the Parthenon, and he has, in the last 2 or 3 years, gone back to teaching. So he is no longer in charge of the Parthenon restorations. You can't, it's like Metro, you can't draw two paychecks from the city. So he had to choose.
It's all very recent that we're talking.
The restorations are very recent. Well, now, let me say, there have been, in the 19th century, there were restorations that began on the Parthenon, and they were well-intentioned and misguided. And they did, actually,
There was one particular man whose name escapes me. It's kind of good we don't want to talk about him by name because he did such bad stuff. In an effort to do right, he was trying to put things back together on the Parthenon in particular, and he would break apart something else to find a stone to put in, and he clamped things together with iron clamps and then leave the iron exposed. And the ancient builders of the Parthenon knew to encase iron in lead, which does not rust. But this man left iron, and even if you put other rock on top of it, there's water or moisture that can always get in. And the iron rusted, expanded, cracked the marble in places that it had never been cracked before. So there have been earlier attempts. This most recent, very scientific work has only been going on since the mid-70s, I believe. And I think Manoli was involved from about 1980 to 2000, maybe as late as 2010. I'm not sure when he went back to teaching, but in that time period, they have discovered so many previously unknown things. And he said one of his goals was to get the walls up high enough so that you couldn't see through it, because it bothered him that people think of it as open air, no roof, no walls, and it always was enclosed and roofed. I don't know. There is some talk about trying to put a roof on it to protect what's left from the elements. And there are certain places you cannot walk any longer that people who were lucky enough to go there in the 60s or 70s got to walk all around in the building. And you can't do that anymore, partly because there's equipment there while they're working on it, but partly because the number of visitors has increased so much, and you know, the pounding of feet, even on stone, will eventually wear it away. So they're very protective. And there's also talk about putting a bubble over the entire Acropolis. I am really torn. I want that to be protected, but I just think that sounds hideous. And I don't think they have enough material left or findable to recreate the roof. And it changed over time, and that's something else we'll talk about. The classical original roof is long gone, and we're talking hundreds of years ago. So we will get to that. Where was I when you asked that question? Okay, we're talking right the recent discoveries about both the techniques for building and how the building itself looked and functioned. Here we're getting it onto the cart. Once again, now he doesn't have physical evidence left, I don't think, for the cart, but you assume certain things given what you do have evidence for. And there is a wonderful little book called From Mount Pentelicon to the Parthenon, and there's a extensive hardback book, and then there's a little paperback that we try to carry in the museum store at the Parthenon that has his drawings and that tells this kind of story that's pretty interesting. And I love this, because here we are going up the Acropolis to the building site, and here you see that here's the cart. Here's a cart that's been used and is being dismantled so they can carry it back. It is being pulled up around a pulley by a team of mules or horses coming down from, so instead of people having to pull it straight up, it's being pulled down by gravity, and the horses who are coming down. Ingenious. It's the kind of thing that somebody who knows can discover about building techniques that we look at the pyramids and we look at these ancient buildings, and we know they didn't have the machinery that we have, and we think, how did they do that? Certainly, an abundance of slave labor
is one thing, just having lots of people. But it's interesting that we have bookkeeping records from the work on the Acropolis, and we know that most of these artisans were paid because they're records of payment. Now, that's not to say they weren't slaves, and maybe many who did some of this work, but it was certainly a mix of paid and unpaid labor. Here's the column, column capital about to be put into place. Now, this was for the building that preceded the Parthenon on this site. So this is prior to 447, actually prior to the end of the Persian Wars. They were building a new temple to Athena. It's debatable, and scholars argue about how many temples to Athena existed on this site before the one we have as a ruin now. There were at least two pre-Parthenon Parthenons, one of which, and this is the one, on almost the identical footprint of the Parthenon that exists today. There was another, an older one that was slightly off that footprint, same general area and same general size. This one was under construction. Clearly they're using marble for this one. And you look at the scaffolding. It's heavy wood and it is all over. It is, they practically had to build the building with scaffolding before they actually put pieces, the marble into place. And here you see the lifting bosses on the column drums. And I don't know if you can see it very well, but just below this, there is some fluting that's been done, and that's they knew enough, probably from experience, to only rough dress the stone until it was complete or a whole section was complete. Then they would come along and do the finish work, the fluting. They would level the floor to where they want it to be, because if you flute a column and then somebody comes along carelessly with a hammer and goes, whoops, just knocked a chunk out of that, You can't say, oh, we'll just take that one out and put another one in. It would mean it was ruined. And not only do you not want to ruin workmanship like this, but this is a house for the goddess. It needs to be perfect. So any effort to, anything they could do to prevent accidents that would damage what they were making was a smart move on several levels. See what we've got here. We've got, this, and I'm going to talk about this in a minute. This is a piece of wood that's the size of the surface of the column drum. It was smoothed exactly and inked, then placed on top of the top drum before they put a new one on. The ink would show where the marble was not level, where the stone was not level, and they would take it off and make that level. Then they would do the same with the bottom of the next drum that was going to go on to make sure that the surfaces were going to match exactly. And that will show up in a minute. They did that with all the stones, so that this building is put together with no mortar. There are iron clamps encased in lead that held some pieces together. And there are centering rods, centering wood pieces. They weren't rods, they didn't go all the way through. But each prior stone, it's easy to talk about it in the columns, would have had a centering piece, and then the next one to go on would have had a dip hole that matched that, so that they could get it in position and have it, they've done that leveling stuff too. When the Persians got as far as Athens, just, this is a few years, and once again, I need to check that date because I'm not sure the exact date. When they got as far as Athens, sacked and burned the city. So here's this temple to Athena that was not complete, but well on its way, and they got to the Acropolis, the Persian army did, and set the whole thing on fire. Now you think, well, stone doesn't burn. No, but it was encased in heavy wood, and the wood burned and cracked the stone. It was evidently an intense fire, and once again, that comes up again later too. So this temple is destroyed. They can't use it, and that is why the Parthenon that we know was built. They took it apart, and some of these unused column drums and building blocks were put into the foundation or where they shored up the Acropolis as a memorial, a war memorial, a way to say, we're not forgetting this. This was too important. This was the temple to our city goddess. It's the Persians, those barbarians, burned it. We will not forget. So there are places, and I don't know if they're still visible or not. I expect they are, but certainly there are photographs that show those column drums from pre-classical Parthenon in place in the retaining wall that helps hold up the Acropolis. Questions about that? This now is the completion of the classical Parthenon, the one we know. And you see what they have done here is devise a crane, and they don't have to put scaffolding all over the building. So this we have inside the Parthenon in Nashville, and you will see it when we go there on our tour, a 1/10 scale model of this crane. Manoli is the one who came up with this idea. He, let's see if I can, you've got a platform here, counterweight with stones sitting on it, rigging, and these two winches on either side that would take several people per side to turn, and the stone goes up here, and there's somebody who has to climb all this to make sure the stone gets into position correctly. Now, when we unveiled the 1/10 scale model at our Parthenon as a part of an exhibition about the Athenian one and the Nashville one, there was somebody who, an engineer from Nashville, who had worked on the Parthenon as a young man, and he said, "That's not right. That's a compound pulley, and they weren't invented until 200 years after this. Archimedes is the one who came up with the formula for that, and he was later." And I thought, oh, rats, have we done something wrong? I trusted Manolis Caress, however, and I thought, I'm going to ask him. And he said, well, Archimedes did live later. Archimedes is the man who came up with the formula that we use for the compound pulley. But people are inventive, and they figure out ways to do things, and they do them and do them and do them long before anybody comes up with a mathematical formula that makes them work the same every single time. So they were both right, and I was relieved. Manolis, in fact, believes that there is a passage in Aristophanes' play Lysistrata that talks about the clacking of the cranes, and people have thought in the past that that referred to the birds, the cranes, and their bills clacking together, whatever. Manolis says, no, that's the of turning this crane and putting these blocks into position, whether it was the Parthenon or one of the others. So he thinks that that reference, which is right about the right time period, is referring to the turning of the spokes of the crane. Now here is one of those just jaw-droppingly wonderful things. When I said the building was put together without mortar, it's that making sure that the stones fit exactly. And when I was there, the one time I have been, and I was fortunate enough to meet Manolis Caress, he was so excited about showing me this, that where the joints are undisturbed, and you see that there is, I mean, we've got a disturbed, this is one of the steps, and you see there's a joint here where stuff is spalled off here, but the joint goes all the way up and just disappears from sight. It is so tight that you cannot see it with the unaided eye. You need magnification. And I, the day I was there, we were going from this tour. The friend that I was traveling with and I were fortunate enough to have be taken on a tour of the Acropolis by a woman who teaches at the university there, and she introduced us to Manolis, and we spent probably an hour looking at things, and then we were supposed to go to the ferry and go out to the islands, and I spent the entire ferry ride writing in my diary, just ridiculous, crazy, because I was afraid I would forget all this stuff. There's so much wonderful information, and this is just one piece, and it makes you stand in awe of the minds that figured this out and the workmen that made it happen. Once more, an aerial view of what this site probably looked like. And here you can see there's the Propylaea, the temple to Athena Nike, and those two buildings exist, the Parthenon, the Erechtheion, those two buildings exist. These other things, these accretions of other buildings have been cleared away. I do want to point out that the Athena Parthenos, the statue inside the Parthenon, was one of at least three statues of Athena on the Acropolis. The whole mountain was largely dedicated to her because she was the goddess of the city. She was, while they worshipped the whole panoply, Athena was the one that was the city's goddess. She was civic. Goddess. She looked after the welfare of the city. Now, there was a statue here, giant bronze, supposedly also done by Phidias, called the Athena Promachos, which is the Athena warrior. And then there was the tiny Athena Polias inside the Erechtheion, really ancient wooden statue. And if we're going to compare things to our society, the one in the Erechtheion, ancient and wooden, was more like a statue to the Virgin Mary. And the one inside the Parthenon would have been more like the Statue of Liberty. I mean, we're talking, even though they called the one inside the Erechtheion the Athena Polias, meaning the Athena of the city, the Athena Parthenon, Parthenos, was the Virgin, that's the Parthenon is House of the Virgin. So the one inside the Parthenon is the Athena as Virgin, but she's the big gold girl, and the one they in comparative terms, it's really hard to do that because in our society we are so careful most of the time about trying to separate church and state, and that was a concept that wouldn't have even computed in their heads. What are you talking about? Church and state. I mean, the church is the state. The state is the church. And that of course, was true for most of European history. So those other buildings are not there any longer. Once more, this is a little better in terms of, here's the Athena Promachos, the olive tree that the west pediment of the Parthenon, which is actually the back, this is what you see first. You're coming through the Propylaea, and you walk up, and this is what you see first. But the entrance is at this end. So the Panathenaic Way coming up here would have come all the way around here. The altar was out here somewhere, and this was the front of the building. This is the west, this is the east, and they oriented their buildings so that, for their temples, so that the sun the buildings would face the sun. Each of the pediments, and here's an architectural term that I presume everybody's familiar with, but may not. This triangular space, any time that you've got a columned building with a pitched roof, you wind up with a pediment. And not all pediments are filled with sculpture. The Parthenon was lavishly ornamented with sculpture, more than most temples. But most temples had some sculpture in the pediments, and they generally told a story, a myth that was associated with the deity inside. And the west pediment of the Parthenon tells the story of the contest between Athena and her uncle Poseidon over who would be the patron god of Athens, which was kind of a plum job. And the story goes that Poseidon stuck his trident, his three-pronged spear, into the rock of the Acropolis, and out came a saltwater spring. He was the god of the sea. He would give them good travel, safe travel on the sea, good fishing maybe. So that was his gift in order to win the city's vote. Athena struck the rock with her spear, and out came an olive tree. So not only food, if somebody could figure out how to brine those things. I mean, have you ever eaten a raw one? Woo! I don't know who thought that up. I love olives, but not raw. But food, olive oil, which is great for cooking and for medicines and for as the basis for perfumes. If they're producing olives well, then that's a great product for trade. It seemed to them that that was the better gift, so they voted for Athena, made her their patron god, and they say that that's why the coastline of Greece gets such bad storms from time to time, because Poseidon remembers how ticked off he is and says... So the east pediment, which we're not looking at here, tells the story of the birth of Athena. And there's more to that, too, that we'll get to later. Do you know that story? And we can talk about it. You'll see it when you get to the Parthenon in Nashville. There is so much missing from the center of that pediment that the only way we are able to even mentally reconstruct it is that Pausanias, who was a 2nd century A.D. Roman travel writer. I mean, he was Greek, but he was writing in the Roman era, and he's kind of like the first Frommers. He was telling people where to go, what sites they needed to see, and he mentioned the Acropolis and this beautiful building on it, and said, and he mentioned the stories on each pediment. And if it hadn't been for his saying in this sort of offhand way, the east pediment is the birth of Athena, we would have no idea what that looked like and how to reconstruct it. And the details of why there's so much missing is for a later week. But anyway, the story of Athena's birth is that Zeus, head god on Mount Olympus, who was not, shall we say, a faithful husband, he got a woman pregnant, a woman named Metis, and then he heard a prophecy that if she had a second child by him, it would be a son who would rise up and overthrow his father. And he thought, not me. So he turned Metis into a fly and swallowed her. Probably not what any of us would have thought to do. And immediately he just had this splitting headache, like a migraine, I think. And he was no good to anybody. And it went on and on. And finally, one of his sons, Hephaestus, who is the blacksmith and the sculptor of the gods, took up an axe and just whacked his father over the head with it. His head popped open and out jumped Athena, fully grown, fully armored. Sure, that's why he had a headache. She was in there rattling around. And he was thrilled. She became his favorite child. She's the only one he shared his magic goatskin, the Aegis, with. So the pediment must, therefore, have Zeus and Hephaestus and Athena, and probably Nike crowning Athena victorious, and then all the other gods and goddesses. So figuring out how to put that together is a challenge for anyone who's going to recreate the Parthenon. And as you will see later, there are arguments about it. There's not a consensus on exactly what it looked like. Now, let me show you the plan and talk about the plan of the building and talk about some terms that will come up over and over again. It is a peripteral temple, that is, it has a portico, a covered porch that goes all the way around it. The main body of the building, the temple, is called the naos, or sacred space, or cella. And so you see that here. And it's made, there is the base for the statue. The pronaos is the front porch, as it were. So here you've got the covered porch that goes all the way around. And at this front end, you also have this entry portico. And on the back, many temples had this opisthodomos, which was a treasury. It would have gratings between all the columns, and it was a treasury. The Parthenon was big enough, however, to have a completely interior treasury, and so this becomes it's called the opisthodomos, but it's like a back porch, and that's one of the things that makes the building a little unusual. The altar to the goddess is here. And when we talk about the decorative elements on temples. The Doric style had a frieze. Every time you, once again, every time you have columns and then the architrave is the board or the stone that sits on top of the columns, making a place for the roof to rest. We presume that early temples, for which we have little or no evidence, because they were wood, used, and here you see it, they would have the column, the wooden column, the wooden architrave, and the roof beams. So in order to keep that from being plain and to keep there from being a hole here, they either covered up everything with a simple board like that, or they decorated the ends of the beams and then put something with sculpture here. So a Doric frieze is alternating triglyphs, that's what these are called, triglyphs and metopes, which sometimes had sculpture on them and sometimes didn't. We also presume that they are holdovers from when temples were made of wood and had to have these things. And after a while, people thought it had to have them, whether it was wood or not. A temple didn't look right, didn't look like a temple if it didn't have triglyphs and metopes and all that other stuff, even though making it out of stone, you wouldn't have to have that. These, we presume, are the remnants in stone of necessary pegs which would have held the wooden pieces together in a wooden temple. The name for these is guttae, not that you'll ever need to use that word. These are mutules. Once again, a word you don't need to, you don't bother writing that down. But these are architectural elements of particularly the Doric order. Now, when we get to Ionic order, there's much, much that's similar because we still have a columned building with a pitched roof. It's got an architrave, but it's a slightly slightly fancier, slightly more elaborate style, and the treatment of the various elements is often different. One of the things that you, I don't know whether I have a picture of this. Yeah, okay. You see that in a Doric temple, which the Parthenon is, that there's a very simple capital. It's this flare out of the shaft and then a block. And there's some cuttings around the neck that give it a little interest. And the flutes come to a knife edge, and there is no base. The shaft comes right down to the floor that it's resting on. When we get to, when we look at Ionic temples, you will see differences there. A typical, fairly standard Doric temple had 6 columns across the front and 13 down each long side. The Parthenon, if you're counting, is wider and longer. It has 8 across the front and back, and counting the corner column twice, 17 down each side. Scholars mostly presume that this was partly Phidias's doing, his pushing those architects and saying, bigger, bigger, give me more room, I've got to put a statue in there. I want this to be beautiful and big and accommodate the big gold girl I'm going to put in there. So we're looking at the east on the left and the west on the right. Here we look at the comparison of the two orders of architecture. And you can, this makes it really clear. Oh, actually, 3, because we've got the Corinthian here. The Doric has no base, simple capital, alternating triglyphs and metopes for the frieze. The Ionic has a fairly elaborate base. They both have 3 steps. And the flutes and fillets are different because the... And you'll see this made clear when we go to the Parthenon in Nashville. The flute edges are flattened off to give it one more surface to reflect light. And the, one of the most obvious differences is the column capital, this scroll volute thing. And then the frieze, see, they both have the frieze. They've got the architrave here and then this that would have had roof beams in a wooden temple. On an Ionic temple, that is a continuous band of sculpture, if it's ornamented at all. Sometimes they left the friezes plain. Just, they were there. They're an architectural element, but not ornamented. And that's one of those things that makes the Parthenon special, is the elaborateness of the decoration. So it's, and the fact that it's got both. That's, here's a, one of those fusion things. The outside, and probably what you notice and see when you look at the Parthenon in Nashville, is this Doric frieze of alternating metopes and triglyphs, which in antiquity told different stories on each of the four sides. Late in its life, or fairly late, in the early Christian era, the metopes on three sides were deliberately vandalized. There's all sorts of speculation about why and who did that. Most likely it was some band of fanatic Christians who thought, we can't have this. But it's very odd what was damaged and what was not damaged. The south side metopes, which are the side closest to the steep drop-off, and that might be why, were left pretty much intact. So the Nashville Parthenon recreates south side metopes all the way around, instead of having four different stories told among the metopes. But the Nashville Parthenon has Ionic columns in the treasury. We'll talk about that again later. It has the Doric frieze, and it has an Ionic frieze. And that, on our building, let me think how to show you that. Well, we don't have the sculpture on the Nashville Parthenon, and I will show you later where to look for that when we go. It's plain. The frieze is there, the space is there, but it's not ornamented because they ran out of money. I'm getting 2 weeks ahead of myself. And here you see the differences in the Corinthian order are very, very small, mostly the capital. I want to compare a typical Doric temple and a typical Ionic temple to the Parthenon so you can see some of the differences. And you are going to see at least two of these places, those of you who are going on the trip, because you'll be in Athens and you'll see the Parthenon, and you will be in Ephesus, I believe. Isn't that one of your stops in Turkey? Okay. So, and then over here is Olympia, which was a site sacred to Zeus, and it's the site of the origin of the Olympic Games. Here is the temple to Zeus at Olympia. We've got the, you see that it's a basic Doric temple, and we've got the roof here, the gutter lion spouts, the Doric frieze, the architrave, the capitals, the shafts, and the crepsisser steps. And look at the plan, and in a minute I'll show you the two compared. But we've got a peripteral temple here, but they're just six columns and 13. We've got a really deep pronaos, but just side columns. There's, the statue takes up all this room. There are no columns across the back here. And we've got no treasury room, but an epistodomos. Once again, deep. Now, they, one of the things about these temples is they're very symmetrical. What you have on one end, you have on the other in terms of building. They may serve different purposes, but they look the same. The sides look the same. The ornamentation may be different, but both ends have a pediment. The columns go all the way around on the outside, and the whatever ornamentation is on the outside goes all the way around. And you see that this was built not too much. It's 10 to 20 years earlier than the Parthenon. So a very typical Doric temple. Here you go. Look at the differences here. The Parthenon down below, the Temple of Zeus here. And see how much shallower this is than this. And it's only got two columns. This one has six. And here is the colonnade inside the Parthenon that surrounds the statue and frames it. And I think that's another innovation of Phidias's probably. We've got this treasury room and a shallow epistodomos compared to this deep one here. There's much that's the same, but there's a lot of innovation. And the interesting thing about the Parthenon is that almost nothing I won't say nothing, but very few of these elements are completely unique to the Parthenon. It's the combination that makes this one so unusual and so special. The statue of Zeus that Phidias made for the temple at Olympia was retrofitted. The temple had been there for a number of years, and he actually, I have to check that too. I think he made this, yes, he made this statue of Zeus after having completed the Parthenon. But since the temple was already there and people wanted this massive, giant statue of Zeus, he made him big, and then there were complaints. Well, if he stood up, he'd go through the roof. Yeah, and Phidias said, I know. He too was chryselephantine, which means golden ivory. Chrys being the Greek word for gold and elephantine, ivory. I will hasten to say that although the Nashville Parthenon's Athena has real gold, there is no ivory. Here is something else that isn't in every temple, and that's this stacked colonnade. And I think a lot of that is to give more room. If you had monolithic columns, they would, to keep the proportions right, they'd be so big around that it would squeeze the room left inside. So the solution to that is to make two stacks of smaller columns, and you get the same height and serves the need of supporting the roof that you want to be that high, but you don't have to have this space taken up at the bottom with your column size. And this is the temple of Artemis at Ephesus, a reconstruction, obviously. And this one is over the top elaborate. I mean, out the wazoo. This is a superimposition of this reconstruction onto a contemporary photograph. And it is an Ionic temple. You see this, see the frieze here is a continuous band of sculpture. You can see the columns have the volutes of the Ionic columns, and you can see the base there. So there's some real clear differences. And this is the temple plan, and the little, I suppose you see these little pieces here. This is what you will actually see. So this is a reconstructed plan based on what's visible at the archaeological site. It is a double peripteral temple. So you've got columns that go, two rows of columns that go to the outside. It is giant. It's much longer and wider than the Parthenon, and it's got three, but it just has one, two, just has eight columns across. But it's got a deep pronaos and a totally different opisthodomos. It is apparently open, as is the pronaos. Large interior space for which there was a cult statue, but only one column behind. This one must be, I don't see an east-west on here, so I take it back. This is the pronaos. If this is facing east and the column is behind the statue, then this would be the opisthodomos, this would be the pronaos. Very, very different and very elaborate. Even elaborate enough that some of these outside columns have, here's a person height. So you get a sense of how tall this is, and they've elaborately decorated these, the lower parts of the column with sculpture. And here is the fairly standard Ionic column. Here's one with rosettes instead of volutes. So you could do some different things. Every temple could be slightly different and have its own elaboration. What are we doing on time? Okay, good. This is the temple of Apollo at Corinth, the ruins of that temple. And this is the first temple that we know of that had optical refinements. So you see, it's 100 years earlier than the Parthenon, 570. And there may have been other temples with these optical refinements, which I'm going to talk about, but this one we know was, and it's the earliest one we know. You can see it's a Doric temple, but look how these are very different. It's less slender. It's less graceful, maybe a little more earthbound. The Doric style tends to be kind of heavy, and in the Greek mind, more masculine than, say, the Ionic or the Corinthian column. But when I talk about architectural refinements, in the Parthenon, the horizontals all curve, the walls and columns incline inward slightly, and the columns, although they taper visibly, with the fattest diameter being at the bottom, or that's what it looks like anyway, the largest diameter at the bottom, larger than the top, so it tapers. But actually, the fattest diameter is about a third of the way up. So instead of being a straight taper like this, it's a gentle curve so that it's not straight. And all those things are not visible if you aren't thinking about them and looking for them. They are subtle, and maybe, and this is another thing that scholars argue about all the time, perhaps simply to give the building a liveliness. The curved line is more pleasing to people. We are all curves. We're not straight right angles. We're not, you know, every part of us curves. And so there's a liveliness or a life in the curved line that isn't in rigid straight lines. So I think all the scholars may disagree about the whys and wherefores. What's remarkable is that it's done, and it's done precisely. So that in the Parthenon, at any rate, if you put an object, say a purse or a lunch bag, at one corner of the steps, and you walk along the long side, put your eye at stair level, there's enough curve, it's 7 inches, that you can't see the lunch bag. It is, and yet, you know, you look at that and you think, well, that's straight. That's a straight, flat step. Not, it's not. And so all the horizontals are curved. The short sides are 4 inches higher in the center than at the corners, and the long sides are 7 inches higher in the center. And the columns incline inward just slightly. They are not much off plumb, but if you were to extend the centers of the columns, the short sides would meet a mile overhead. So, you know, the difference in this and this is very, very slight. But it's enough to keep the visual tension of the building pulling inward instead of looking like it's going to flop out. Question? The question is, could it possibly be earthquake protection to pull in like that? You mean, yeah, possibly. And it's an area that's prone to earthquakes. So they might have known something. If I can remember it in the week between now and seeing you again, I might ask if any scholar has ever posited that before. People have said, you know, water runoff and for the curvature. But in the absence of proof or some written thing, we don't really know why, just that it exists. And in the Parthenon, all the horizontals, so we're talking, we're talking steps, three of them. The columns have to be different heights and slanted on the edges to accommodate this. So this is, a drawing is an exaggeration, but the architrave, the frieze, the roof line, all have to be curved in precisely the same way. And one of the things that Manoli told me that I find hard to wrap my mind around is that because of these optical refinements, there is only one place in the building where any stone fits. So he can look at a stone and measure it precisely and know that it won't go here, even though maybe it was found over here. It must fit somewhere else because it won't fit there. All these things are so precise and so tiny. When he came to Nashville for the first time, he looked at the building and he said several very complimentary things about the Nashville Parthenon, and I was pleased to hear it. But he looked at the step and he says, "It's 2 centimeters too tall." Okay, well, let's fix that. The man probably knows more about the Parthenon than any single individual who has ever lived, because I'm not sure that the people who created it had the kind of overarching vision that somebody who worked on it centuries later would have. And I think that that's where we're going to stop today. My plan is to spend next week on the ancient Parthenon again, come with questions, try not to make them too hard, like dates and stuff. I will try to have some of these things that we've talked about today that I've been vague on known. But if you have questions, and if you want to email me questions between now and next Friday, do, and I'll try to come with answers. The easy thing is wesley@parthenon.org. And I will, if I will respond to the extent that I got your message, I'll see what I can find out, or just answer it. And then the last 2 weeks, we'll talk about the Nashville Parthenon, why it was built, the centennial for which it was built, and the making of its permanent, putting Athena in, all those things, so that when we all get together at the Parthenon the 5th week, you have more than you ever wanted to know. Thanks so much for being here.